Hi, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. My name is Shaylin Dafka, and I'm a Senior Health Promotion Specialist here at PTCC, and I'll be moderating today's webinar, Cannabis, Tobacco, Alcohol, and Nicotine, Opportunities and Challenges for a Public Health Policy Framework Approach. If you're having trouble logging on to the webinar, please call the 1-800 number for PTCC. This number is 1-800-363-7822, and please note that you'll have to dial in to the audio number, which is 647-723-3984, access code 7281777. For those of you who are logged into our webinar, you will see the presentation on your right. On the left hand of the screen, you will see a chat box. We have set aside time for questions after the presentation, but during the presentation, anytime, please feel free to enter any questions into this box, and we will address them when we can. We may not answer the questions in order, but we'll do our best to answer each question at the appropriate time. Please also note that today's webinar, the phone lines are all muted to minimize background noise. And before we begin, we'd like to get a sense for how many of you are joining us today. If you could please fill out the poll and indicate how many people are in the room with you. We'll give you 1 minute to fill this out. Thanks very much, everyone. Now I'd like to introduce you to our presenters. Dr. Rob Schwartz is the Executive Director of the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit and Associate Professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health, University of Toronto, with interest in research, evaluation, and knowledge exchange. Dr. Michael Chaitin is scientist at OTRU and assistant professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health, University of Toronto. Michael's main areas of research include smoking cessation, smoking comorbidities, and understanding the impact of widespread retail availability of tobacco. Take it away, Rob and Michael.
Thank you very much, Shaylin. Today's talk is on cannabis, tobacco, alcohol, and nicotine, opportunities and challenges for a public health policy framework. This presentation is largely based on a paper that came out recently in the Canadian Journal of Public Health. I think it is now in press and accessible on the web. And this paper describes a meeting that was led by Mark Kirst, Rob Schwartz, and myself that brought together a number of different researchers and advocates and practitioners working in these policy areas on alcohol, tobacco, and cannabis to discuss some of the common policy challenges and some of the differences between these substances and some of the differences in both in language and in opportunity that each of these areas faces. And so my task for today, though, is to talk a little bit about the epidemiology of tobacco and cannabis, tobacco and cannabis primarily. I'll put aside alcohol slightly, primarily because alcohol is just so common, it overwhelms the other two, and talk a little bit about the associations between tobacco and cannabis. But each of these drugs, alcohol, tobacco, and cannabis, have a number of similarities. They're all common psychoactive drugs that are used for recreational purposes primarily. But the way that we deal with them in Canada and across the world is very different. They have very different policy structures. There are very different histories of the way that we have treated these drugs and the way that we sell them and regulate them. The prevalence of use of each of these is very common. However, the patterns of use are quite different. Alcohol is very widely used. The most recent estimates actually suggest that more than 75% of people have ever used alcohol in the past year. But both cannabis and tobacco have high levels of use of trying. Alcohol, though, is very frequently used by people, but generally not every day. Most people use it on a regular, a frequent but irregular basis. On the other hand, cannabis is mostly, the prevalence is mostly about trying. People, most of this is people who've used it a few times, and there is a number of people who use it more regularly, and very few who use it daily. And finally, tobacco, where most users of tobacco are in fact daily, regular users. There is substantial co-use of these substances. Alcohol is used by nearly everyone who uses any other substance. So this is where we're going to start putting it aside, because you can assume if someone is a user of just about any substance, they also will use alcohol as well. So for now, we're going to focus on cannabis and tobacco. And in the past year in Ontario, 38% of current smokers have used cannabis in the past year, compared to 10% of never smokers. So that rates of cannabis use are quite high among current smokers compared to the rest of the population. And there is concern as we change, or potentially change, our regulatory framework for cannabis that we might also see a concomitant shift in the rates of tobacco use, that if we have more people using cannabis, we may see more people using tobacco as well. Some evidence, however, suggests that this may not necessarily be the case. This graph looks at the rates of co-use of cannabis and tobacco among grades 7 to 12 students in Ontario over the past 30 years. And what we see here primarily is that the co-use of these substances has fluctuated dramatically over time. In the 1980s, we would expect that someone who used cannabis would also use tobacco. Over 80% of regular cannabis users were also smokers in the late 1980s. However, if you were a tobacco user, that would tell you very little about your cannabis use. Tobacco users were slightly more likely to use cannabis, but not significantly. But it was significantly so, but not dramatically different from the rest of the population. However, currently, we've seen the exact switch of that situation. If you have someone who is a cannabis user, you can almost guarantee, particularly among youth, who has a tobacco user, you can pretty much be assured that a youth tobacco user will also be using cannabis in some form. And conversely, that currently, if you know someone is a cannabis user, that doesn't tell you very much about whether or not they will use tobacco or not. There is some relationship between the two of them, but we have to be careful that this relationship is maybe social or cultural or policy oriented, and not necessarily about the substances themselves. On the other hand, there is a tradition and a practices of not just people being tobacco users and being cannabis users at the same time, but in actually using cannabis and tobacco together. I took this list, and I think this is a very much incomplete list, from the Urban Dictionary, and these are different terms that people use to describe the practice of using tobacco and cannabis together, from mulling to rolling spliffs or moki to create batch or shoddy, rizzles or blunt. These are different forms of combining the use of cannabis and tobacco in some way. And there are good pharmacological and also practical reasons in terms of equipment and so forth why that is the case, why people want to do this. And so unsurprisingly, we have relatively high levels of this mixing behavior. The CAMH monitor found that 31% of past year cannabis users report mixing tobacco and cannabis. This is even true for non-tobacco smoking, people, that 15% of non-tobacco smoking cannabis users report mixing. And so these are people then who are using tobacco but are not reporting it or counted in our traditional tobacco use statistics. So given the co-use of these substances, we just wanted to ask a polling question that also relates to previous current and historical debates about the two. Which substance is more harmful? Is it, do you feel it's tobacco, cannabis, or that both are about the same? So I'll give a minute for this. And I guess while people are answering, I'll respond to the question. In Colorado and Washington, it seems that 20% of the consumers of cannabis are daily users, but they count for most of the consumption. Is it the same in Canada? I actually don't know the answer to that question. Our monitoring tools for cannabis are limited. We're expecting the next iteration of the drug use, and it used to be CTUMS, and now it's CTADS, its survey will be coming out soon, and that should include some more information about marijuana use and sort of frequency. And so hopefully that will come out soon. So the...
Sir, on your right.
Do I do this?
You want to look at the results here on the right.
Close poll?
You could just get to the results.
Okay. So what we found, the responses, suggest that tobacco is considered more harmful by 58% or 59%, and both about the same at 38%, and very few consider cannabis to be more harmful. And the reason why this is a particularly valid question is that we suspect, at least on a theoretical basis, that the harm for both of these substances is due to the burning and inhaling of organic matter, the incomplete combustion of burning leaves. And that process and those organic matter aspect to it is common to both burning of tobacco leaves or cannabis leaves or, you know, the leaves in your garden or any other form of incomplete combustion that you would inhale. So at least on a theoretical basis, we suspect that most of the harm is due to this process. However, epidemiologically, we don't find this. That our current evidence suggests that the mortality due to tobacco is substantially greater than the mortality associated with cannabis. Estimates suggest that tobacco is associated with 37,000 deaths a year, much larger than that associated with alcohol or the category of illicit drugs, which includes cannabis as a subset of that total. This is also true of the costs associated with substance use in Canada, with tobacco use accounting for about $540 of costs, social costs per person, compared to about $463 for alcohol and $260 for illegal drugs. Again, with cannabis being a component of that cost. That's not to say that the risks of cannabis are nil. A more recent study in 2015 did break out what the evidence suggests what the mortality morbidity associated with cannabis was. And this right-hand column looks at the mortality and finding that a few hundred deaths a year are associated with cannabis use. These are mainly in two categories, associated with motor vehicle accidents and with cancer. However, the major burden of cannabis use has to do with morbidity. This includes morbidity associated with motor vehicle accidents, but is primarily about use disorder, that is, about cannabis addiction and treatment for cannabis addiction, affecting nearly 400,000 Canadians each year. In Ontario alone, there are over 30,000 people treated for cannabis addiction by the Ontario healthcare system. Other risks associated with cannabis include respiratory risks, such as chronic cough, wheeze, aggravation of asthma, sputum production, sore throat, chest tightness, shortness of breath, and hoarse voice. as well, a commonly cited issue is that of cognitive deficits associated with cannabis use. And the strongest evidence for these deficits occurs in exposure that happens either prenatally for maternal exposure or youth exposure. And the evidence suggests that cannabis does have an effect, particularly on the developing brain, which means that it may have an effect up until the age of about age 24. After that point in time, there are other deficits noted among adults in terms of cognitive deficits, but some of these have been found to dissipate over time once youth stops. For both of these, there is still the case where there may be confounding. It may be that people who use cannabis are more likely to have some of these concerns or may engage in other activities which create the cognitive deficits, or the reverse may be the case. I think evidence is still building on these, particularly among adults. To mitigate some of these risks, some cannabis users do use vaporizers that reduce some of the respiratory effects, or there's suggestion that they do. And often these vaporizers are in fact sold as tobacco products or tobacco vaporizing products. But most of these, like the one pictured here, which I think is a volcano, these are not recommended for actual tobacco use. I think it creates a smoke that is very harsh and unpleasant when you smoke tobacco in it, despite the way it's advertised. Cannabis users also use e-cigarettes to smoke cannabis, and this is primarily in the form of liquid cannabis, such as cannabis oil or other forms of distilling cannabis in order to use it in the e-cigarette device. Tobacco and marijuana and cannabis are also linked in terms of medical marijuana. And I'm not going to go into the evidence around the medical marijuana, and there's a whole body of research that goes on different aspects of this. But to point out that the prevalence of smoking is very high among medical marijuana users, that in fact, if we looked at it as a population subgroup, this is one that would be one of our highest priority populations in terms of tobacco use. The prevalence of smoking is about 51% in Ontario. To look at it a slightly different way, that we see 13.5% of current smokers use medical marijuana in the past year, and this compares to only 1.9% of never smokers. So the medical marijuana issue is very much focused among smokers. Now, each of these substances have very different regulatory frameworks and very different ways that we treat these frameworks, and also different ways of which we conceptualize policy options. And each researchers and advocates tend to be a bit siloed and often are focused on either alcohol or tobacco or cannabis. And we often don't spend enough time talking to other researchers to see what the potential outcomes are. Because many of these policy solutions that we examine would not be subject specific. They work on things like economic forces of supply and demand or theories of health policy behavior that have nothing necessarily to do with the pharmacological properties of each of the substances. And so to get at some of these differences in perceptions, as part of the meeting that we had asked participants to fill out a survey to examine their perceptions of similar type policies by substance types from participants. And as part of this webinar, we'd just like to go through a very similar sort of exercise. So the first question then is, on a scale of 1 to 5, where 5 is most important, how important is it to limit the sale of tobacco to tobacco-only stores, akin to LCBO outlets? And I'll give a minute for people to provide their responses to this. to results. And we can see a range of options here, with most feeling it's quite important to 56.5%. And so if we move on to the next question, this is very similar. So in terms of how important is it to limit the sale of cannabis to cannabis-only stores, akin to LCBO-type option? Results. And here we see that participants on this call, nearly over 70% of them feel that it's important to talk about cannabis-only outlets. And which is, I mean, this is a very consistent, and in fact, the rates of people who think that tobacco-only stores are important are probably much higher among this audience than among sort of the general tobacco control community. And this is interesting because we expect that there's, in terms of controlling access to substance, that there shouldn't be any reason why cannabis would be better served in an LCBO-type outlet as would compared to tobacco. But we have different expectations for what those policy options might be. And this is true across a range of different policy options. For instance, we could see here that in terms of importance that, as people showed, that availability of retail options was important for alcohol and cannabis. But there were other differences too. For instance, maintenance was seen as a very contentious issue for people working in the alcohol and cannabis field. But for people working in tobacco, we didn't even know what that term meant. And instead, we talk about reduced risk products, which is a similar sort of way of similar sort of concept, but a much different way of talking about it. Other differences include that penalties are not are a very accepted strategy among alcohol researchers. Things about fines for public drunkenness or jail time for drunk drivers, where penalties are extremely contentious. Among tobacco, this is something that we don't do. There are a number of different differences here too, but I'm just going to break here to let Rob Schwartz speak, but maybe take a minute to answer the questions. So
we have a number of questions here, so we can try to get through as many as we can with the time that we have. We do have a number of questions related to the charts that you put up related to mortality. First question here is this direct causes of death or indirect? Would you be able to speak to that?
So this would be contributory. It's measured in the same way that that we're comfortable with the 37,000 deaths a year associated with tobacco. And so that's the methodology used to calculate that is the same as the methodology used to calculate the cannabis risk, which is based on understanding the relative risk associated, independent relative risk associated with it. So it would be clearly that it's a part of the causal pathway in the case with motor vehicle death.
We have another question, thanks for that, Michael, related to the health effects associated to tobacco versus cannabis. The question is, would these numbers not be related to the usage? For example, if cannabis was used as widely as tobacco, would the numbers be closer?
That's a really great question, and it's a really important question that we'll have to watch carefully. There are a number of differences here. One is that people use cannabis differently than they use tobacco. So there aren't as many people who smoke cannabis, 20 times a day compared to cigarettes. So that is one important difference. We're also, I think, we'll be learning a lot about the independent use of cannabis. Right now, most of our studies are really confounded by tobacco use when we're looking at cannabis alone. Most people who are heavy cannabis users are also heavy smokers. And the people who are heavy cannabis users who have never used tobacco, that's a very unique group and small. And so we don't, I personally think that we don't know yet what those results are going to look like when we have more widespread use among people who aren't using tobacco.
Okay. We do have a few more questions. I think we do have time to go through some of them. The question here is, do we have any stats on the morbidity or mortality of co-use?
I think we could probably try and I don't personally, but I think those might exist. But in terms of mostly as those are, people have looked at the idea of co-use as a way of trying to control out that if you're interested in the effect of cannabis, you need to control out the use of tobacco. And so we should probably be able to see if there is an effect modification or an interaction between cannabis and tobacco use. It's very likely there is, but I don't have those numbers on the top of my hand.
Perfect.
Head. Yeah.
We do have a few more. With the medical marijuana users, did they become tobacco users after they began smoking medical marijuana? Any sense of that?
We don't have that in our data. It is very likely, though, that most people start smoking as teenagers. Start smoking tobacco as teenagers. So it is very likely they were smoking tobacco before. But it may vary. We don't know what the direction.
Has marijuana legalization in other jurisdictions increased the smoking rate?
I'm not sure. That's another good question. I think we're still waiting on some of the data. I believe there was something that came out of Colorado, but I'm not sure of the effect. It will depend, I believe, on the policy, though. So even if it does happen in one jurisdiction, I think there are ways in which we can make sure that those directions are that use of tobacco doesn't change.
And one more question before we move on. Are penalties for tobacco use becoming less contentious with the increase of more smoke-free policies and their enforcement?
It's Rob here. I don't think we know the answer to that question. The question about the point about penalties and their being contentious in this slide was this is based on our survey of experts. So it's a one-time snapshot of some 15 or 20 people. We wouldn't have data on the contentiousness of penalties for tobacco users. I don't think we asked that in CAMH monitor, actually.
I mean, we have in particular times, but this question that we asked of experts is often what people think is feasible is different than what the general public thinks are feasible and policy questions. From the expert perspective, penalties are something that most tobacco control are not interested in pursuing.
It's a question of who do you blame?
Okay, so with that, we will...
Very good. Okay, so I am going to take you through thinking a little bit now about the policy frameworks that might make sense given the differences between these two or three substances that we're talking about. So before we get into the public health approach and what that would mean, let's just look for a second about what are the current policy frameworks for tobacco and then for cannabis. So for tobacco, we have a well-established set of policies, the World Health Organization, we have an international treaty, don't have that for anything else in health, and they're quite well known. you know, there are some gaps in our existing policy frameworks. We're not completely protecting people from secondhand smoke. And there's a lot of talk about product regulation now and about more revolutionary things that have to do with actually controlling the marketplace. The marketplace meaning, you know, the way that tobacco is produced, disseminated, and sold. Right now, it's a complete for-profit enterprise. The tobacco industry is actually doing what it's supposed to do. It's trying to sell as much tobacco to as many people as possible. Some people are now talking about tobacco endgame types of measures, which would aim primarily at that, but also at the retail sector. Getting back to the first polling question that we put out today about whether tobacco ought to be sold in tobacco-only stores, for example. And this is arguable. And we had a discussion, Michael and I were both at a drug policy meeting on Friday, a national drug policy meeting, and the current tobacco control policy was put forward as a public health approach. Well, we're going to talk about that a little bit and see to what extent is our current tobacco policy framework actually a public health approach. And, you know, if it is, then how well is it doing? Cannabis, on the other hand, as we've said, is a very a different kind of substance. You know, if it's already clear from what we've said so far, tobacco, there are no known positive effects, whereas with cannabis, there may indeed be, and adverse effects may be preventable. The legislative frameworks, it's illegal, and the illegality and criminalization of cannabis has not had its use at nothing, and it's gone up and down and up again over time, and a lot of youth are using cannabis, which is something that most people will agree is not a good thing. So the argument that is being made and that the current federal government has taken on is that it's time to change our whole policy approach to cannabis. And there is a lot of talk about a public health-oriented approach. Indeed, the Minister of Health, Jane Philpott, addressed the drug policy meeting on Friday, and she said, we are intending to take a public health approach to cannabis policy in Canada. What would that mean is where we want to go a little bit today. What is a public health approach? And I was actually very happy. Ian Culbert, who's the executive director of the Canadian Public Health Association, spoke at this meeting, and he posed the question, because a lot of us talk about a public health approach. What do we actually mean? And if people are telling me, Rob Schwartz, the executive director of the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit, you know, that we have a public health approach to tobacco, and a fifth of Canadians are using tobacco, then, you know, and 37,000 people are dying each year, that's over 100 people each day, I wonder, is this really a public health approach? Let's see what we mean by a public health approach. The CPHA, Canadian Public Health Association, has a nice policy document on its website. This is the name of it, what I'm going to put in the next few slides is taken directly from that. So, you know, it's about health promotion, health protection, population health surveillance, and the prevention of death, disease, injury, and disability as the central tenet of all initiatives. So that means that as we are thinking, for example, about cannabis, that, you know, we may be thinking about, oh, increased government revenue. We may be thinking about taking the burden off of the criminal justice system. We may be thinking about providing a revenue source for certain populations. But the central tenet, if we take a public health approach, is about the public health consequences. You know, if you like, this is a health in all policy kind of discussion. What else is a public health approach? Well, it ensures that the interventions, including policy and programmatic interventions, are done in such a way as to be attentive to the potential benefits and harms of substances. as well as the unintended effects of the policies and laws implemented to manage them. So, again, thinking about cannabis, you know, one of the unintended effects of the cannabis being illegal is, in fact, that it's caused a huge burden on the criminal justice system. It's criminalized many people and has caused them huge burdens in life. They can't get jobs. They can't get certain kinds of subsidies. They're not eligible. They're completely marginalized for possessing, even just possessing, not just not selling, even just possessing a little bit of cannabis. You know, in some places, the jails have been filled with such people, and many fines have been paid. You know, this has consequences for the social determinants of health, because folks who are criminalized are then often very poor and unable to take care of themselves in many ways. So that's an example of an unintended effect. So really, it's looking at the overall potential benefits and harms of the substances and of the policies that would be taken into account. So it's a very comprehensive look at a potential intervention. All right, this is getting back a little bit to the first half of our presentation, but I like the way that the CAMH, Cannabis Policy Framework, has compared alcohol, tobacco, and cannabis. And in the top row there, you see on a scale of 0 to 100, you know, this is all literature-based, evidence-informed. So comparing tobacco and cannabis, it's 20 to 100. On the scale. Alcohol is somewhere in the middle, but closer to cannabis. Interestingly, on impairment of mental functioning, tobacco gets a 0, cannabis a 30, and alcohol is the highest of these. So it's really important to pay attention to the some of the potential harms of these substances when we're thinking about a public health approach to regulating them. So we do have, as many of you will know, although surprisingly for me, a lot of people don't know about our low-risk drinking guidelines, because I've become interested in alcohol policy as of late, and I keep asking everybody I know, are they familiar with the low-risk drinking guidelines? And most, almost everybody that I ask outside of public health has never heard of them. And if I ask them what they would be, they get it way wrong. We're going to get to those in a sec, but I didn't know until Friday that we also have, we don't have official low-risk cannabis use guidelines, but the beginnings of guidelines have been suggested in an article that is published in the Canadian Journal of Public Health in 2011 by some of my colleagues from CAMH and others. And, you know, this is what it would look like. Don't use it before young adulthood. Where exactly that falls is arguable. Won't get into that right now. Don't use it even near daily. Okay, so that goes back to some of the questions that were posed about the relative harms or potential harms of cannabis and tobacco. Don't use it. Okay, use it occasionally. Like, this would be like an occasional smoker rather than a daily smoker. So don't use it every day of the week. Not smoked means don't use the smoked variety of cannabis, because of what Michael mentioned before, that the combustion or partial combustion, the inhalation of that, is known to be damaging quite clearly. So in this article, they say, first of all, don't smoke it. Use a vaporized form. It doesn't even talk about an edible form, but some people would say use an edible form. It does, by the way, it does talk in this article about some of the risks of the vaporized form, which are known. So that's not completely benign either. They know more, it seems, about the risk of vaporized cannabis than we know so far about the risk of e-cigarettes. So that's something that is to be taken into account. Don't use the stuff that's of really high potency. So the THC levels, as we understand, have gone up dramatically since the time I was younger, and that's potentially quite problematic. A lot of people don't know about the relationship between impairment stemming from cannabis use and driving problems, so the suggestion is not to drive for 3 to 4 hours after using cannabis. And they should not be used by certain subpopulations. People have cardiovascular problems, psychosis, or are pregnant. Interestingly, it doesn't talk about people who are thinking about being pregnant, I think, as do the low-risk drinking guidelines, but that probably would fall there either. So, you know, this was interesting, and when we're thinking about a public health approach to cannabis, you know, looking at these kinds of things, which are evidence-based, it helps tell us something about what a regulatory framework might consider having as part of it. And just by way of comparison, the low-risk drinking guidelines, which Tim Stockwell, who presented at an alcohol policy forum in May, suggests that these probably need to be modified based on the newer evidence and brought down somewhat. So instead of 3 drinks a day for men, he seems to be talking about 2 drinks a day for men. Important about these, I keep telling people, to me 15 drinks in a week sounds like a whole lot, 3 drinks in a day. Some of us, you can count on 1 or 2 hands how many times we've had that many drinks in one sitting or in one day, but these are the evidence-informed guidelines. But importantly, here, you should have 2 days of abstinence. So have non-drinking days every week to avoid what's called here developing a habit. And these are from Canada's accepted. These are Canada's guidelines on low-risk drinking. What about tobacco? What are our low-risk tobacco guidelines? I never heard of them. But this is what I think they ought to be. because we know that smoking tobacco cigarettes is absolutely harmful. We know that there is no health benefit of smoking tobacco cigarettes. So, you know, this is one way, thinking about low-risk guidelines, to consider some of the things that we might have in a regulatory framework that is based upon a public health approach. So, just comparing these products in terms of their risk, what does this tell us about how much of each of these products is okay? So on tobacco, we would say that no, we shouldn't have any tobacco whatsoever. Whereas, and on alcohol, we would say we shouldn't have more than 2 drinks per day. Cannabis, we like it doesn't say so far in the sort of the pre-guidelines how much in terms of numbers. It just says you shouldn't use it almost daily, certainly not daily. In terms of how often, for tobacco, we would say never use it. For alcohol, not on more than 5 days per week. And for cannabis, we would say not almost daily. So, you know, would that be similar to alcohol or less? It sounds to me like a bit less. Is there any good in using these products? In tobacco, we would say no. Cannabis, you know, we do have medical marijuana. The testing for it as a medicine has not been completed, although there seems to be a fair bit of evidence suggesting that it is helpful for some things in some situations, but it's certainly not confirmed. And in alcohol, there is a debate. So those of us who follow the literature coming out, you know, we seem to be wavering. You know, we used to think that red wine in moderation was actually beneficiary for cardiovascular. More recent research suggests that it's not. So where I'm putting it is a maybe, because I think that the evidence is going a little bit back and forth on whether alcohol has any positives. So this is Rob's vision of the current state of our public health approaches or non-public health approaches to regulating these three substances. It's upside down. Seems to be upside down to me. So tobacco is available at every corner store. It's a legal product, and it is widely used. Cannabis, on the other hand, which is causes the least harms, the least morbidity, the least mortality of these three substances, is the most regulated. It's not legal. And alcohol is somewhere there in the middle. So what would make sense in terms of a rationalized public health approach to regulating these three substances? Well, for tobacco, you know, there are no real known benefits. You know, even there are perceived benefits. The smokers, you know, say that it actually calms their nerves and relieves their stress. My colleague Michael here has pointed out to me and to others on more than one occasion that this perceived benefit may be not a real benefit, because we know that tobacco users who quit report overall reduced levels of stress and improved well-being. Are there really economic benefits of the tobacco industry? You know, some governments are afraid of getting rid of tobacco, perhaps because, you know, people are going to lose jobs. The convenience stores are going to lose business. The government is going to lose revenue. Well, these are all arguable, because if you look at the actual costs, direct health costs and societal costs of tobacco, they are at least as large, if not larger, than the revenues and whatever is being generated in terms of economic benefit. And the argument, other argument on there is that if the money being put in tobacco is put elsewhere, then it will generate other economic benefits. And finally, the perceived harms of the contraband problem potential, if we have more stringent regulation, are not real. And here I will refer you to a recent article that we have in the Canadian Medical Association Journal called Debunking the Contraband, the Contraband Myth. And we can say with a fair bit of certainty that if we have much more stringent tobacco control, including much higher taxes, and at the same time, we keep on clamping down and do more against contraband, it's not going to be a huge problem. And the benefits will far outweigh the small harms of some small bit of increased contraband. On the other side, you know, the unintended effects. Remember, we were talking about a public health approach. We said we have to look at both the intended and unintended effects of both of the policies. Well, the unintended effects of our current, if you call it a public health approach to tobacco, is that we have a fifth of Canadians still using it. There's a higher prevalence amongst the disadvantaged parts of our populations. We have vested commercial interests, and arguably we have a government, or we have governments, that are addicted to tobacco revenues. So this is the beginning of an outline of how a more specific public health approach might look for a rationalization of the regulation of these three substances. So I just want to make sure it's clear. This is very exploratory. It's meant to get discussion going. And I'm interested in hearing your comments and suggestions on it. So in terms of what the marketplace would look like, a public health approach, you know, should we have for-profit commercialization of these products? So I would argue that a public health approach for tobacco would say absolutely not, because the current for-profit situation means that the companies need to do more to sell their legal products. So it ought not to be for profit. A similar argument might be made for cannabis, given what's known of the potential harms that it would cause. So if a for-profit marketplace for cannabis is going to be advertising, promoting its products to youth, it's going to be promoting more use of its products so that we're going to have daily users using it frequently. If we're going to have the smoked variety, then that is not a good idea. And we see already in the public debate, including some government pronouncements, that they are considering perhaps a not-for-profit model. And in alcohol, you know, given its widespread use and that when used properly, its damages are relatively few, we might consider a restricted model, perhaps something like we already have today. What about the availability? How available should we make these products? So at the retail level, how should we have these things at every corner store? Should we have them in restricted outlets like the LCBOs? So it seems to me that given that tobacco is the most harmful amongst these, that it should be the least available. So if we have cannabis being sold, if we have alcohol being sold in LCBO stores, then maybe that's what we need for tobacco as well. So I say least, most, more, and most for tobacco, cannabis, and alcohol respectively, based on their relative harms, the relative harms that we know. This is arguable, but it's something I think we need to look at carefully. What about cost? Right. So the cost of a pack of 20 cigarettes is something like $10 in that ballpark. So that's not very much for a cigarette. Now we're talking about pennies for a cigarette. The price of a drink. We do have low minimum price pricing on drinks. Okay, now drinks are less harmful than cigarettes. Is somewhere around $2.50 if you buy it in a restaurant or a bar. And I don't know what the cost of cannabis is. But moving forward, okay, this is one way to think about it. Again, that you know, the cost of tobacco should be higher than the cost of cannabis and alcohol. Should we allow any advertising and promotion? Well, in tobacco, we're already agreed. No, absolutely not. In cannabis, maybe we want to agree there that should there should be no advertising and promotion of the product. In alcohol, you know, the argument might be for a restricted advertising regime, and there are many people now. You know, my colleagues who work in the alcohol area are not happy with the level of advertising that we have currently in Ontario, where there's certainly a lot of lifestyle advertising going on. That also relates, by the way, back to availability. You know, even though we have LCBO outlets, they seem to be cropping up in more and more places, at least in the cities. There's more density. They're open more hours. They're a lot more attractive than they used to be when I was younger. Should we allow their use in public places? Well, you know, tobacco, we would certainly say not. Should we allow cannabis use in public places? Well, certainly we wouldn't want the smoked variety of cannabis to be used in public places. What about other forms? Maybe not also. And alcohol, we already do restrict. And finally, on the question of minimum age. So given that we know that cannabis affects brain development. We know that alcohol affects brain development. And there's more and more evidence suggesting that nicotine affects brain development. The suggestion would be to have a common minimum age. If you'd asked me, 25 would be better than 21. Is 25 feasible? Digestible? Unlikely. So, you know, one thought might be to start off with something like a minimum age of 21. So those are our thoughts about what a public health approach to regulating tobacco, cannabis, and alcohol might look like. And your suggestions are welcome. This is a sort of work in progress, and I think it's really important that this community has discussions about this now and uses this to influence the current discussions about the development of cannabis policy and the current discussions about alcohol policy. Ontario is now redeveloping its alcohol strategy. And I would say this is potentially a window of opportunity to talk about some major changes in what tobacco policy might look like in light of how it compares with these other two substances. So thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Rob, and thanks, Michael. We do have a number of questions, and we have some time to get to them. So the first question that we have here is the risk comparison related to just adults? Chart that you showed earlier, Rob. We can go back to it.
Yeah, the risk comparison would be largely about adults. It's you know, it's commonly understood that among youth, the effects are very bad for cannabis in terms of brain development. Youth are also, if you start using cannabis as a youth, you're much more likely to become addicted to it and to become a regular user of it as well. Is it cumulative? So the literature, I'm assuming you're talking about cannabis. And I do want to say I'm not an expert in cannabis. Neither of us are big experts in cannabis. We're tobacco folks who are learning more about cannabis now. But what I've read is that the damages of cannabis use do get overcome. After stopping to use it for most folks after a few years.
We do have a number of questions which you may or may not be able to answer as the tobacco expert, but what is the risk of developing dependence of cannabis after trying it in young adulthood? And a similar question related to that, about is there a substantial risk of addiction?
So we'll try and answer this one together. For cannabis, what I read recently is that for youth, 16% of youth who start using cannabis will become addicted. And if you start using it in adulthood, that goes down to 10%. Michael, do you have the numbers for tobacco on your off the top of your head?
So it depends on how you measure it. So the numbers that I had for cannabis was about 10%, and for alcohol it's about 15%, and tobacco about 30%. Cannabis 10%, alcohol 15, tobacco 30%, which is, the DSM criteria of addiction. I would look at another way that for tobacco, among people who have ever tried a whole cigarette in the CCHS, between 50 and 60% of them have gone on to become daily smokers at some point in their lives. So for tobacco, it's very common to become at least that first stage of dependence of daily smoking, which is much, much higher than alcohol or cannabis. But one of the things to be aware of for this, and that dependence in many ways can be driven by the environment. And in a lab, for instance, among rats, if you're trying to induce dependence in rats, it's actually quite difficult to do for tobacco. Despite this huge effect of a huge capture rate is the terminology for tobacco, it is relatively hard to do. You can do it, but it's a slightly different setup. In particular, that setup for tobacco is really driven by making sure that you have the right environment for that to happen, which is important. So when we're talking about dependence, that ability to be addicted to something and to stay addicted and the difficulty in quitting is often driven by these factors that we've been talking about, things like availability of the substance, cost of the substance, and other social desirability. So it's not just a pharmacological effect in addiction. It is also a social and cultural one, too.
Now, related to that, thank you very much for that, Michael and Rob. We have a question related to the risk of addiction for occasional users of cannabis. I wonder if there's any comment you'd like to make on occasional versus regular cannabis or tobacco use.
I think that the 10 or 16% figure holds. You know, if you start using it occasionally, then you are likely to progress by that percentage to regular use, and not by that percentage, but you're likely to progress and then become addicted.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you very much. We have a more of a comment here about the Canadian low-risk alcohol drinking guidelines having contributed, having not contributed to reducing alcohol-related morbidity and mortality, and that alcohol is still widely used. How do you feel about promoting low risk?
Yeah, Nancy, I share your concerns on this one, but, you know, it's not nobody's been able to evaluate this. If people don't know that they're out there, then they aren't likely to be doing anything. And I do wonder, as I said before, I mean, I can count on one or two hands how many times I've had three drinks in a day. And is this actually going to cause some people to drink more? You know, but there's an overall calculus. Maybe those people drink more, but it's still low risk. People who drink way more drink less. So I think there are question marks around that. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's certainly, I once did an experiment with my family doctor, and I told him I was drinking at the low-risk guidelines at that limit. I nearly got, sent away for treatment. It is a high number, and I think people look at it differently. It's generally the point holds, though, about how much, how can we implement low-risk use guidelines, and what kind of enforcement mechanisms and what kind of public health messages are we sending with these type of guidelines.
Perfect. Thank you. We do have questions, and then some actually being answered by the folks who are listening in as well. Is there any research on the unique physical impacts of edibles compared to other modes of delivery? Do you have any comments on that?
I think the comment afterwards, I think Pat's comment about Health Canada suggesting no more than 3 grams of cannabis per day in any form, I think, is a response.
Yeah.
But neither Rob or I are in particular position to be able to answer that question.
And could be related to another question that we have from the audience about why not restricting these other forms of cannabis in public. They speculate perhaps it's because the smoking form has the potential to harm others. Just as a thought to your conversation.
Yeah, it may very well be that a public health approach ought to restrict to all forms in public. Just a thought, just thinking right now, but we for sure wouldn't want to see the smoking variety. And somebody asked a question, I think, before about whether where cannabis has been legalized, has it increased the smoking rates? That's a fear that I have. I don't think we have that data yet, but that certainly is a fear.
I'd like to make a note here that Rob was mentioning the contraband article that OCHU prepared, and for everybody on the line, that was posted. A link to the article was posted.
Yeah, we can send it to
around. Yes, absolutely. So the link is also there, and we can send it around. To get back to some of the questions, we have more questions which you may or may not be able to answer, but is there any evidence that legalized cannabis contributes to increase in other illegal drug use?
So, I mean, I think at the policy forum, they had folks from Colorado, actually, from the enforcement side, and others, and there does not seem to be evidence now that this is the case. The whole notion of cannabis being a gateway to harder drugs seems to be largely untrue, according to the evidence.
And even the association between that changes. I mean, it's that in the same way that you would have to say that at different time points, harder drug use was associated with cannabis use, and at different time points, tobacco was more associated with harder drug use than is cannabis. So it does seem to be culturally determined.
We have a couple questions here about minimum age and whether or not 25 is missing the point with the age limit related to getting teens out of the illegal market, and about any modeling for Canada that has looked at minimum age in relation to initiation or prevalence of smoking tobacco.
So I'll take the first one, and Michael will do the second. You know, Trudeau's initiative, you know, that's great to get teens not using it. The evidence suggests that it shouldn't be used until early adulthood, until the brain is quite developed. Moreover, a higher, what we know from the minimum age studies regarding tobacco is that when we have the minimum age of 19 or 18, that the folks who are younger are initiating, that if we were to raise it to 21, it would, then we would go down instead of 15 and 16 year olds initiating, it might go up to 17 and 18 year olds, right? And if we raise to 25, then we would bring that up even further. So, you know, again, we're not, you know, recommending for sure what exact age it should be, just indicating that a higher age is what the evidence would suggest.
At least for, you know, if you're basing it on brain development. There may be other reasons to set a minimum age, as another comment suggests. In terms of minimum age for tobacco, it's a really good question about Canadian-specific data. There is, I think, a little bit of research, and we're hoping to do more as preparing a proposal with some other folks in BC about working to develop some of those models and to understand some of the historical relationships about the effect of minimum age. It would likely be very similar to the work that we've seen coming out of the U.S., which there's a recent Institute of Medicine report on the potential that modeled the implications of raising the minimum age, and which did show that raising it to 21 or 25 would have a large effect. Certainly, it was the biggest change was raising it up to 21, and then more of a marginal change up to 25.
Okay. Thank you very much. We do have one more question. So if anybody has any questions, we do have a little bit of time left, so feel free to type them into the chat box. The question is, the discussion of decriminalization of cannabis as a criminal issue, would this encourage the use of cannabis because it's not being seen as dangerous?
So a general answer to that is that the illegality and criminality has actually resulted in quite high rates. So amongst youth, the proportion of youth using cannabis is higher than the proportion of youth using tobacco. So would even more use it if it was decriminalized or even legalized? It's possible, because we don't know for sure. It's very contextual, right? So we haven't seen rates skyrocket in other jurisdictions where legalization has happened. But the argument would be that even if people start using it, we would be able, because it would be legal, to actually educate people and have regulations in place so as to minimize its use amongst youth. For example, to regulate the substance itself so that the level of the psychoactive substances wouldn't be overly high, to have it priced in such a way that would be relatively inaccessible and sold in a responsible manner.
Perfect. Thank you very much. I believe we have one more question. If anybody else would like to ask, actually, I do see one here. The question is there any discussion or plan for a global FCTC-like model for cannabis or alcohol to help governments?
So there's a question about that, about conflict of interest. Just wanted to note that I will speak for myself and say I have no conflicts of interest, and I apologize for not pointing that out at the beginning.
And same, I have no conflicts to clear.
And the question about, is there a plan for an FCTC-like model for cannabis or alcohol? So I think it would be way premature to be talking about that for cannabis, since most governments around the world are not yet even discussing, I think, the legalization of cannabis. And I'm not aware of anything happening with alcohol at this point.
I think there may be the talks of a global alcohol treaty that, again, some of the same issues with the alcohol industry are consistent with the reasons why an FCTC was useful for, or has been at least partially useful for tobacco, that there is an industry and there are needs for governments to coordinate actions, and that many countries without the resources to develop require that sort of a larger framework in order to deal with sort of the industrial industry factors that limit their ability to implement regulations. So I believe, other people would know better about that, but I believe there are some discussions.
Okay, thank you. We do have another question here about, is there a place for harm reduction in tobacco, cannabis, alcohol policy frameworks? Rob, I know you spoke about this a little bit. For example, if vaping is less harmful, making it relatively more accessible than other forms, many alcohol frameworks suggest making higher alcohol content products more expensive, for example.
Absolutely. I mean, harm reduction would be an integral part of a public health approach. You want to minimize the harms. You know, whether vaping would be considered part of tobacco policy is arguable. It's pretty certain that vaping is less harmful than tobacco. And if we could have vaping instead of smoking tobacco, then that would be great. And the idea of making it more accessible for smokers than tobacco cigarettes makes a lot of sense. The thing we need to be careful about in vaping is that it's not benign, and we don't want to recruit non-smokers or people who otherwise would not have become smokers into vaping. Okay, there's a consensus about that. It's a calculus that people are working on doing and needs to be completed. But absolutely, I think a public health approach would need to consider the benefits and harms of various forms of harm reduction.
And one of the important lessons learned in terms of harm reduction from alcohol and cannabis is that when we talk about, when other substance areas talk about harm reduction, they talk about policies, they talk about programs, they talk about they talk about treatment. When we talk about harm reduction for tobacco, we talk about products, and we should also be talking about policies and about programs, and that is where harm reduction happens. The fact of having a safer product doesn't necessarily entail automatically harm reduction, but harm reduction is part of that process, and we should certainly consider them as part of a public health framework.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for everybody on the line for participating, and thank you very much for your questions and your comments, and thank you to Rob and Michael for your great presentation and for answering all of the questions. And I want to say to everybody that following this webinar, you will be sent an email that will contain a link to an evaluation survey. If you could kindly take a few moments to complete the evaluation, it would be greatly appreciated. Your input will help PTCC and OTRU improve our webinars and host future learning opportunities that really meet your needs. Thank you very much, everyone, for being on today, and we hope to see you next time.